Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is food writer, mother, Tamar Adler, and we're talking about her new book. It's one of the best cookbooks I have read, and I've actually read this book cover to cover, not like when you do with other cookbooks. It's called Something Old, Something New, Classic Recipes Revised. Welcome to the show, Tamar.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be back.
Now, talk to me about the setup for this book. And I have to say, the recipes in this book really brought back all sorts of stuff from my childhood.
I'm excited to hear about that.
May not even been dishes I ate. My parents ate them. You know, like I'd be out in a restaurant and my parents would have had these dishes. Or they appeared in movies or books I read and stuff like that.
That's where they had existed for me, and that was what excited me. There were so many things that I had read about but never tasted, and I think that they were probably intrinsically linked to a kind of othered nostalgia, an idea that I had of what things were like in the past, or a particular story, or the beauty of the sounds of the words, like nothing is called Allah anything anymore. Allah is quite beautiful. And, you know, I felt this strange attraction to them. But then, like any time I tried to get close, I was pushed away because I didn't have recipes for them that really felt like they fit into my life now. They either had too many steps for the amount of time I, as a mother of a toddler, can spend in the kitchen, or would produce something. I mean, a lot of the recipes in that book originally had beurre manier, which is butter that you coat in flour and then add to a sauce, which kind of gives everything this uniform kind of thickness, slightly undercooked floury thickness. And at some point in time when your parents were ordering them in restaurants, that was beloved. You know, like today there's kimchi everywhere. And
oh, you're right. How did that happen?
Love that. I think that's a whole other story. But there are tastes that make sense in one era that don't make sense in another. But
can I stop you right there and ask you about that? I mean, why is it the taste, and has this always happened through the centuries, that tastes just evolve and change and then pass away?
Absolutely. And it's more than taste. It's what actually mattered in food. I mean, we right now live in a really kind of popular democratic era for the cook, I think, because, you know, international flavors, meaning flavors from other countries and other cuisines, have been embraced. And food is really, I think right now is appreciated for what it tastes like more than what it looks like. Rustic cooking has been in for a long time, and the rustic cooking of lots of different cultures in, and you're not trying to get something that looks perfect or that's the perfect, or that's a certain texture, but that wasn't always true. At different points in history, what we wanted from food was much more about what it looked like. And we often wanted it to have a kind of like, almost machine-like perfection. I mean, it was just about what we don't even think of it now. You think it's about taste because right now food is about taste. But for example, when blancmange was very popular, in the 19th century, especially earlier in it, it probably tasted pretty bad. And its texture, it had to be really hard and really perfect. And that was all that mattered.
It's interesting because a couple of months ago, I interviewed a woman who published a picture book of recipes from the 60s. Found, you know, classic jellied recipes.
Right.
And it was all about like making it look like weird stuff, like you would make little people out of the food.
And it
was really, and first of all, the ingredients, like the other shock factor is that the ingredients, it looked just horrible to us today. Yet this was the stuff that was in all the so-called women's magazines at that time.
I wrote a story, a cover story about this for the New York Times Magazine a few years ago, based on the Betty Crocker recipe box, which
I had that as a kid in my house.
You did?
Yes.
It's pretty amazing. and crazy, and psychedelic. I mean, it kind of fits in with this new era and new movement toward cannabis cuisine, because it's like, it's out there. You know, it's like Ken Kesey level psychedelic, like little mini dogs,
yes,
standing up around,
right,
like lime green jello with like whipped cream on top, and you're just like, and then porcupine, it's supposed to look like a porcupine, so there's, it says to like carefully place slivered almonds
right
along the back, and you got, you think like, what were they on? You know,
it's amazing, like, to see photographs of those things, yeah, too, from these, yeah, these magazine recipes, and this, you're right, it looks totally like, were people on drugs or, and what were, right, they thinking? And there has to have been no idea of taste, because I have to believe they tasted crazy. This has gotten to the point where a whole bunch of us want to get together and have just like a jellied food like thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have to say, as you probably noticed in my book, I do use gelatin a lot in it, because I think that when something is jellied, but it's lightly jellied, it's going to be such a wonderful, delicious experience. And I think the timing for that aspect of this book is really good, because a lot of people have been recently getting interested in regional Chinese cuisines, and texture is a really big idea in Chinese food. Right. And there are all of these savory jellies that are not like rock hard where your spoon would bounce off if you tried to cut into them, but are kind of like lovely and refreshing. And I like, I would love to go to an all jellied things party, but it would be great for it not to be ironic, but to be appreciative and to use,
right,
you know, if you use less gelatin and you keep yourself away from food coloring, you can end up with, I mean, œuf en gelée, which is a recipe in my book, is just one of the most wonderful festive appetizers. And it's just a lightly boiled egg set into slightly gelatinized, really flavorful chicken stock. And it's like refreshing and surprising, and actually tastes quite current, like something you would have in a Sichuan restaurant or something like that.
Let's talk about the layout of your book, before I want to make sure that the audience knows about this. First of all, it's broken into seasons. You have each chapter starts out with a sort of a seasonal suggested menu with a wine pairing. And then you go through different appetizers. You go through main courses, you go through, the amazing thing about your book, and I mean this in the best possible way, is that I could read it. Your writing about food is really interesting and very entertaining. So I found myself just
that
like
makes me so happy.
But you know, you, the whole little thing you wrote about clam chowder, which I thought, you know, I would, you really write well. And this idea of writing a cookbook, not just collecting recipes, but having an attitude, having a specific point of view and putting it in there, that's almost like a tradition that's gone now.
Yeah, I know. It's a funny thing, because I didn't intend to write this book so much. I originally pitched it as, this one's going to be a cookbook, because my first book was very much full of point of view and writing. And,
right, right.
It wasn't that I didn't like that. I really did. But I thought it would be nice, because I also write for Vogue, and because I was about to have my first child, I thought, oh, this is going to be a really easy one, because I'm just going to kind of stand in the kitchen with old recipes and then work on them until I'm happy with something and I think it tastes wonderful and a little old fashioned but current, and then I'll just pop them into a book like everybody else does, and it'll be done. And I couldn't do it. It just didn't. That wasn't how it worked. And so then I ended up with, I mean, I just remember when I sold this book saying, this one is just a cookbook. It's just a cookbook. It's going to be,
it's
not going to be confusing. It's not going to be like this kind of strange, eccentric, original thing. And then
it became that.
Yeah, it kind of did. And I think it's because.
But that's what's great about it.
Good. I mean, I hope people like it. I know that it's a strange thing to do, but I guess the truth is that the cookbooks that I like the most are mostly or all writing. I have never been drawn to the pictures in cookbooks or cookbooks with just recipe, you know, little recipe
right.
notes. I tend to find those quite, like really forced. You know, people try to make them charming and anecdotal, but everybody has a story about the time they roasted a chicken or burnt a chicken, and it doesn't ever really connect it to anything else for me. And I think that...
Well, wait a minute. You have some weird stories in this book, and you just sort of say them in passing. And there was some stuff that I'm going like, at one point, you're at the Tattinger Champagne Chateau, or the heiress of the Tattinger Champagne Chateau.
The heiress, yeah.
Yeah, and then you're on a beach in Vietnam with gangsters, you know, and your book sort of proceeds like that. It's just like, and then they're outside your window at night making sounds like cats.
Oh, that was crazy.
I can imagine. But you got a recipe out of it. That was good.
You got a recipe, yeah. There are more anecdotes in this book than there were in my last one. A criticism that I heard about my last book from people was that they wanted to know more about my life. And I don't think I put a ton more about my life.
Oh, no.
But a little more.
That was an interesting pairing right then and there, because I came across both of those in one setting. And
to be honest, the dinner with the Tattinger heiress was lovely, but really had nothing on the day spent with Vietnamese gangsters, which was a fantastic day.
You wrote that their nails were really long.
Their nails were really long, and I noticed that it was the first thing that kind of clued me into there being something a little bit off, because that wasn't just like a typical, it's not like, oh, Vietnamese men of a certain age have long nails. That's not the case. We were on China Beach in Vietnam, and I suddenly went, why are their nails so long? And then saw a gun in one of their bags.
Oops.
And then noticed a lot of jewelry and went, oh my God, what have we gotten into? But we made it out.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is food writer and mother, Tamara Adler. And we're talking about her new book. It is it's a great read and a great collection of recipes, something old, something new, classic recipes revised. It was amazing for me to read names like Clams Casino, Oysters Rockefeller. They all sound like gangsters from Dick Tracy book cartoons. Waldorf Salad. I mean, these are things that literally were part of my childhood, and to finally, I never get to taste them.
That was my exact feeling.
But some of the recipes go much further back.
Yes.
You have stuff from the 19th century, and you actually mentioned stuff even earlier. Talk to me about, do you collect cookbooks?
I collect old cookbooks. Not new cookbooks. Mm-hmm. And I don't collect them in a real collectory way, in that I don't think I've ever spent more than $40 on a cookbook. So, I mean, I guess, like, as much as I have a budget collection of old cookbooks, which means nothing is terribly beautiful or terribly old.
Great.
Every now and again, somebody gives me one, which I love, because, you know, they might have spent $45, which makes it a little bit more beautiful and a little bit older. Publishers send me new cookbooks, but I tend not to read them very much
Are they really readable, or are they just collections of recipes?
They're collections of recipes generally.
Yeah.
And when they are written, they tend not to be written in a way that really holds my attention, which doesn't make them less useful. I mean, you know, cookbooks are and should be used. I think they're more like the manuals you get for, you know, setting up your easel or for fixing the spark plug in your engine than like other things. You know, they're in the kind of realm of craft guides.
Exactly right. So they're practical, but that's it.
Yeah, I think they're practical. And I when I find one that is really practical, I like it. The issue, though, is that, you know, there are some practical books that are still written well. Like, they need to be a book that can't be anything else. Like Strunk and White, the grammar manual.
Right.
Which is probably...
You don't want that to be chatty. Book. You don't want that to be chatty. You want it to have the answer and tell you what exactly you need to be doing.
But it's beautifully written.
Yes, it is. And you quote books in your in this book, like and some very famous people like MFK Fisher, but there were people that you quoted in this book, the Vicomte de Maudoui.
De Maudoui, yeah. Oh, he's great.
Okay, you got to talk to me about him, because as soon as I read that name, I sort of envisioned some, you know, ancient European trapped in a chateau somewhere.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, I have...
He was doing all these things where you had to, like, really stir it a lot or do weird things physically tough.
Oh, yeah. His recipes are hilarious because he has several recipes, or at least one recipe, that that instructs you to stir it until your arms get tired. which I thought was just an incredible directive. but to give you a more complete sense of him, the subtitle of his book, which is called The Vicomte in the Kitchen, is The Art of Cooking, Preserving, Eating, and Drinking with the Manner of How to Make Simple Dishes, All Kinds of Banqueting Stuff, of the Wines to be Drunk with Them, and of Sauces, Syrups, and Jams. Also, a selection of recipes from many continents, countries, and counties, together with many economic and distinguished novelties, with finally a choice of menus for all occasions, seasons, purses, and moods. I mean, that's a subtitle.
That's a subtitle. That's amazing. Those were the days when the subtitle would, like, really would get, it was like watching the preview of the film that showed you all the important points of the movie.
Right. You're kind of right. You don't need the book at that point, right?
No, you don't. I know exactly where he's coming from at that point.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, you describe yourself as a lazy cook. I cannot believe that.
Well, you should come over for dinner then.
Okay. But you're trying out all these old recipes. That's, like, not lazy.
Well, I have to eat.
Okay. So you said, like,
so that makes it lucky. You know, it's not like I'm always amazed. My husband, after his work day and after he's eaten and everything, often goes and sews.
Oh, cool.
And I'm impressed with that because I don't do that. You know, my craft is also what I need to do to survive. So, yeah, I stand in the kitchen and make recipes, but more often than not, I've also made dinner.
Yeah, see, that's the advantage to that over sewing. Although wear something. I mean, he could repair things with sewing, and also
he does. Yeah.
See, but, I wish I knew how to sew. Yeah.
There's something very practical and lazy about having your creative thing be also the thing you get paid for, be also the thing that you have to do to make sure that, you know, people don't go to bed hungry. But I guess what I mean by lazy is, you know, I know people who do project recipes. Like, they'll say, oh, yeah, we like to spend, you know, 4 hours working on this
yeah.
one.
Oh, I know those here. I know those people.
And, you know, and I think that's great. I'm not interested in that. I've never cooked like that. And none of the recipes in this book actually require that. There are definitely some of them, like when you have to, you know, make an aspic or something like that.
Right.
It just means you have to have broth and then you have to add gelatin and chill it. So that's like passive time, meaning you do that at, you know, 10 a.m. to then eat it at 6 p.m. But for the rest of the day, you're not standing in the kitchen watching it chill. You're, you know, doing whatever you're doing with your day. And that's what I mean by lazy. And I would never, you know, I know people also who would make, you know, make consomme, make broth, then make consomme, then add gelatin, then chill it. And I could never do all of that. I would only ever make some kind of an aspic or gelled thing if I already had broth that I had made weeks before and frozen. I have a short amount of time
but, you know,
for cooking.
I think that's true for most people. And the thing that I think that's what I liked about the recipes in the book is, even though they may seem slightly exotic to me or nostalgic, there was a sense that, yeah, I can make these.
I'm so glad that it felt like that, because the names themselves, I think, could be intimidating if you didn't actually then open up the book and read them. And that's part of the reason. I mean, I used many of the original names because I think they're beautiful, and it would be, I think, doing all of us a great disservice to get rid of those kind of beautiful, romantic, fanciful French names. But then when you get to the thing itself, it's pretty easy and pretty fast. And I think what I also mean by lazy is just that there are probably instances in which doing an extra step, which were in many of the steps that would have been in if the recipe, if it had been written 60 years ago or 100 right. years ago, might improve it a tiny bit. You know, caramelizing onions separately, then removing them, and then caramelizing something else. Maybe that would have made it incrementally better. But I would never do that.
Yeah, you never seem anal retentive about your recipes. And I mean, it seems like they're all doable. They're all like, and again, for people who have lives, this is the kind of cookbook where you can cook something interesting and different, but you totally understand that people have lives, that they're not going to spend their life on the meal. I mean, and I mean that in the best sort of way, because these are all interesting. I mean, just to read a recipe for crepe Suzette. I mean, which is one of those names that everybody's heard of, and then I'm so glad nobody's eaten. I've never had a crepe Suzette.
Yeah.
Now, deviled eggs. You brought deviled eggs back. I talked with that with my PT 2 days ago. I was talking about this book, and when I was talking about that you were bringing back old recipes, the first thing she mentioned was deviled eggs. And I said, you wrote about deviled eggs, and she was like so happy you wrote about deviled eggs.
I mean, they're so good.
I know they are. I remember those as a kid.
So good.
I did have those as a kid.
And something that I wrote in the book that I firmly believe is that, I mean, I didn't make the following analogy, but it holds up. I've read before that there's no such thing as bad pizza. There's just good pizza and better pizza, which I pretty much agree with. I mean, like, I live in upstate New York. We do not have a lot of, like, Neapolitan pizzas here with, you know, imported mozzarella and DOC tomatoes. But pretty much any pizza you have is, like, or in my opinion, any pizza is basically good pizza. And I feel like that, and then there's great pizza, but that's the range. And with deviled eggs, that's also the case. I mean, even, like, the worst deviled egg is pretty good. It's on the pizza scale. It's like there are good deviled eggs and there are great deviled eggs. And in the book, I give a prose recipe for the way I make them, which is
That's
like
right.
I make homemade mayonnaise and I add lemon and olive oil and that's it. And they're like very simple but kind of rich and a little bit lemony and delicious. And then I add a formal recipe for what I think are the most delicious deviled eggs I've ever made or tasted. And they're kind of like you make a Caesar salad and then put it inside an egg. And so you get all of the flavors that we really do look for now. Like there's the umami of anchovies and a little bit of vinegar, lemon juice, garlic, mustard, Parmesan cheese, and then thinly sliced romaine lettuce. So it's every ingredient that's in Caesar just kind of smushed up and stuffed into an egg. And they're so amazing that I kind of feel like when people first started eating deviled eggs, like whenever the first human thought, I'm going to take the yolk out and add some mayonnaise and paprika and cayenne to it and put it back in.
Yeah.
And it tasted so good that they thought, like, this is an improvement on the egg. That's how I feel about the Caesar salad shoved in there. It's so good.
There are recipes and I obviously never heard of before, and I was just fascinated by the names. And you talk about the carrots Vichy. When I think of Vichy, I think of Vichy France, and I think of the movie Casablanca, where they throw the bottle of Vichy water out in the barrel at the end.
I don't even remember that.
Oh, but at the very last scene, you know, at the very last scene where Humphrey Bogart's there with the prefect of police, And yeah, they've shot the Nazi guy.
Think of a beautiful.
Right. Before that, he's got the bottle of Vichy water and he throws it in the trash and he goes, okay, this might be the time to change sides or something. I can't remember. And Vichy water is actually mentioned in Vichy is also mentioned in To Have and Have Not. So everybody's association with Vichy obviously is like, ugh, it's Nazi France. But there's this great recipe called Carrots Vichy.
Well, Carrots Vichy were very popular certainly in the middle of last century. But I think that there's a recipe in Julia Child's. I'm not sure. I could check. It was a very popular thing to cook carrots in a lot of butter and water. And I thought I could come up with a way of making it more delicious. And I also looked up recent iterations, and I tried them, and they also traditionally has a lot of sugar in it. I tried, you know, there was one like Sam Sifton added maple syrup instead of sugar. I did that. I tried all these different things, and none of them were really good. And then I tried just boiling really great carrots and putting a lot of olive oil on them. And that was great. Julia Child has so many recipes. I mean, sorry, so many ingredients. Oh, no, here it is. It's, brown stock, sugar,
right,
butter, soda water. It's just you make a very sugary syrup and you cook carrots in them and they end up tasting like they have too much sugar in them.
We're almost out of time. And actually, we've barely talked about things that I want to talk about. I want to mention before we go the beautiful little drawings and watercolors by Mindy Dubin in the book. Hello?
They're lovely.
They really sort of set a different tone for the book, too.
Yeah. I didn't want photographs because I think photographs make people think that they failed if their dishes don't look like the photograph.
You're exactly right.
Yeah. And Mindy makes these beautiful, sort of slightly comedic that you don't know why drawings. And so I would either cook at her house or send her pictures of something I'd made, and then she would sketch it or paint it. And I just think they're beautiful.
My guest tonight has been food writer, mother, Tamara Adler, and we've been talking about her dynamite new book, Something Old, Something New, Classic Recipes Revised. It'll be a book you actually read and enjoy, trust me. Tamara, it's been a real pleasure.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.